hardball hitting with a baseball bat. Kick up your heels, kid, and leave them all flat. What does it mean to be American?
This is Democracy Optimist. Here's your host, Professor Joshua Douglas of the University of Kentucky Rosenberg College of Law.
Welcome to Democracy Optimist, where we bring you the good, the bad, and the ugly on voting rights and election law with a dose of hope sprinkled in. This is a really special episode of Democracy Optimist. It's the last episode before the 2024 election. We are also doing a live recording at the University of Kentucky Rosenberg College of Law. I'm thrilled to be here with students, faculty, and other members of the community to discuss issues that are fundamental to this show. What are the actual facts about how we run our elections, and how can we improve the election system? We have our great team here with us, including our producer, Tom Martin, and our sound engineer, Neil Kesterson of Dynamics Productions. They create the real magic that makes this show sound so great. My law student research assistant, Stephen Dabney, is also here. Let's give them all a round of applause. So before we continue, let me first encourage all of you to make a voting plan this year. Kentucky now has 3 days of early voting on October 31st, November 1st, and November 2nd, in addition to Election Day on November 5th. We also have vote centers, so you can go to any vote center in your county. If you're listening from another state, you can find easy information about the voting process online. Also, make sure to research the candidates. VoteSmart.org and TurboVote are both great places to start. Okay, Tom, let's dive in. We're going to cover some of the themes from previous shows, as well as key issues as voting begins.
Okay, let's start at the very beginning. When we came up with the idea for this show, you decided to call it Democracy Optimist. And there was a lot of debate among some of us who are a little bit more pessimistic about whether that was the right message in these times that we're going through. So do you still think it was a good idea?
Yeah, it's funny. A lot of people still criticize in some ways. You know, how can you be so optimistic during the election season that we have right now? But I'm an optimist, and I think optimism is not about just thinking everything's going great and everything is going to be great. I think it's about recognizing hope for the future. I think it's about what's possible, what we can strive for. You know, at the end of most of the interviews with our guests, I asked them whether they were optimistic about democracy, even in these times when democracy seems like it's under so much threat. And virtually all of the people said they are optimistic. Let's listen to a sampling of them.
I'm so optimistic, actually. We do have some challenges when it comes to information, but since the designation of elections as critical infrastructure in 2017, we've actually seen tremendous progress across the country in making elections secure and resilient. And that gives me a lot of optimism.
People ask me what I'm worried about in the election, and what I prefer to say is what I'm not worried about. I am not worried about whether the election will actually be run well. I am absolutely confident that the 2024 election will be run very, very well, with almost all voters finding voting is incredibly easy and convenient, that they can choose to vote either early in person or by mail or on election day, as well over two-thirds of states allow. There's only three states that basically require you to vote on election day, and those are Mississippi, Alabama, and New Hampshire. Most other states, there's another option. So voting is convenient, it's easy, it matters, and those election officials will make sure your votes are counted properly.
The work is very rewarding because I think I can speak on behalf of election officials across the country when I say it's never lost on us that representative democracy is in our hands, and we are the stewards of making sure that every eligible American has the opportunity to cast a ballot, to register to vote, and choose who's going to lead their local and state and national government.
I have tremendous optimism for the voters of this country to make their voices heard, make choices that reflect the representation that they want to see in their government. And I would encourage all voters to continue to engage. I know it can feel overwhelming. I know it can feel frustrating to continue to see the sort of political fight always in DC without much happening. But I think it's so important that people continue to engage. And I have great optimism that voters will do that again.
I'll tell you that on democracy in particular, I've seen a huge uptick in interest in the last couple of years. I ran on democracy issues when I first was seeking office now 6 years ago. And it was something I talked about at the doors and people responded well. And they said it was something that they cared about. But it was sort of one issue that they cared about out of many. And now it's really risen up in people's priorities and it tends to be a top four or five issue from constituents.
So let's think about what we just heard from those clips. You had people who were Democrats, Republicans, people working on local elections, on a national focus, and all of them said that they are optimistic about democracy. And that was consistent throughout this year of interviews that we had. I'm optimistic because of those responses. I'm optimistic because of the response that we have received to this show. I mean, all the time I hear people say, I heard your show on the radio or on streaming services, and it was such a refreshing breath of fresh air about what is possible and how we can make sure our elections stay fair, free, and secure. I'm optimistic because the people I speak with are so engaged. Because we have a large group of law students here who care about democracy. And if we're not optimistic about what is possible, then it's my view that we won't be able to move our democracy forward.
Well, Josh, by my count, you logged about 30, maybe north of 30 interviews for this series. And so quite a few people involved and a lot of inspiring stories. But among all of them, which did you find the most inspiring?
I have to choose just one. Can I do two? Because there were two stories that really struck me and I think about a lot still. And they weren't people who were politicians. They weren't election officials. They were everyday Americans who have made a big difference on the issue of felon disenfranchisement. Both Deb Grainer and Desmond Mead told us their stories about how they had made a mistake, how they paid the price, they served their time, and they lost their right to vote. But then each of them told us about what it meant to regain that fundamental right to vote, to have a place in democracy where their voice does matter, inspiring so many others. Let's listen to what each of them had to say.
Okay, first, here's Deb Grainer with her story.
I moved to Kentucky at the end of 2008 with my husband, who got a retirement job becoming a tour guide at Buffalo Trace Distillery. We got to run a lovely house. We joined a church. I looked for work. It was hard to come by any kind of employment. And I suffered from an increasing amount of depression and started drinking rather heavily. And over a two-year period of time, things got really bad for me. And I, in a drunken blackout on Halloween in 2010, I caused a fire in our rental home, and I was, of course, arrested and convicted of arson. It's been a long battle. I finished my probation. Fortunately, I never had to go to, I was never incarcerated. In my court trial case, I was pleaded to a lesser felony. I was told if I pleaded guilty, I wouldn't have to go to jail or prison. So I did that. And I finished my probation in the five-year period. It was mostly unsupervised because I'm not really a big troublemaker. I had a bad time and made a terrible mistake. And so when I finished my probation and really realized that I could not vote, I always had before back home in Pennsylvania, when I found I couldn't vote, I applied to the governor for clemency, and of course never heard back from him at that time. And then I found Kentuckians for the Commonwealth. And they have been working on the situation of felony disenfranchisement for close to 20 years now. So I joined them in 2018 because even though I'm not much of a numbers person, I'll never forget these numbers. At that time, it was out there that over 310,000 Kentuckians were not able to vote because of having a felony in their past. That equaled 1 in 10 of voting age people. And for people of color, that was 1 in 3.
Wow. And, you know, Kentucky has one of the strictest laws in the country. And Deb, I love your bravery in openly sharing your story in an effort to explain what happened and also to try to help people. So in 2019, Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear granted voting rights to thousands of people convicted of crimes. And Deb, you were one of those people who got your right to vote back. What was it like to vote again in 2020? What went through your mind when you voted?
Well, it was really kind of a particularly stressful time for most of us because it was right in the beginning and mid COVID. So we had filed for absentee ballots because we didn't think we were going to go into to vote in person. I spilled coffee on mine. And so I went to vote in person and they saw that I had an absentee ballot. So they weren't going to let me vote, or we had to sort it out. Fortunately, the county clerk was there. I had met him in the past and I went in there, mask on my face, and I got to vote. It was a very freeing feeling and healing, although I knew, like you said, the work's not yet done because there's so many other folks out there that were not in that 140,000 to 170,000 people that were affected by Governor Beshear's executive order.
So that was Deb Grainer. She was telling us about being convicted of a felony, losing her voting rights, and then seeing them restored after she served her sentence. We have another story. Desmond Mead had a similar message. Let's listen.
This country was founded on second chances. That's what this country was founded on. And so you making a mistake does not automatically exclude you from being a part of this country. However, fair does. You're punished for your mistake. Once you served your time, when the debt is paid. Like when you pay the last car note or the last mortgage payment, you have no expectations of receiving a bill the next month in the mail. When does the punishment stop? And I'm going to tell you right now, I have yet to find anyone in these United States of America that will tell you that they don't ever want to be forgiven for anything that they've done for the rest of their lives. I mean, we even have bankruptcy laws. After 7 years, you give them a clean slate. So if a person done their crime, you strip them of their rights, they serve their time, give them the rights back, let them move on. Because let me tell you, you have our country have much more to gain by restoring voting rights than we have to lose. As a matter of fact, there's nothing to lose and everything to gain.
Tell us about the day when you went to vote after having your rights restored.
Wow. Let me tell you. So first time I had opportunity to vote after voting rights were restored. I remember walking up when I'm walking up to the voting location and thinking, man, I'm walking on hollow ground, because I started thinking about the blood that was shed by so many people in this country for independence, for rights, civil rights. I thought about all of the volunteers that was collecting petitions and donating their hours in the sweltering heat and humidity of Florida to help pass this amendment, right? And I was like, man, no, I am walking on hollow ground right now. And then when I went and I got my ballot, I went to the booth, I realized that what I was engaged in was a sacred act. I walked on hollow ground to go and commit a sacred act. And it was an act that transcended above the politics, above the implicit racial biases. It took me somewhere much higher than that. I realized that I was engaging in something that didn't validate me as a Black man or as a Democrat or a Republican. It validated me as a human being within a society whose voice mattered.
I mean, think about the stories we just heard and the message that both Deb Grainer and Desmond Mead told us. They used the power of their individual stories of the redemption that they found to convince others to change the laws, because, you know, what is democracy but for everyone having a say in our elections, everyone being treated equally. And what I love about what we just heard is the power of stories, the idea that individual people can make a huge difference to our democracy. It's one of the things that I do so much, and one of the reasons I really loved doing this show is we talked to so many people and just heard their stories. And, you know, Desmond Mead went all around Florida. He drove, I think he told us, what, 50,000 miles a year or something, to convince people to put a ballot measure on the ballot in Florida, which overwhelmingly passed with over 60% of the vote, to change Florida law to re-enfranchise people who had been convicted of a felony. Now, of course, there's a ton of push and pull here. We heard about how the Florida legislature has tried to undercut some of that state constitutional amendment. But it started with a person who said, I'm going to stand up. I'm going to stand up for what's right. I'm going to stand up for democracy. And if you look at the history of voting rights, you see that same kind of story. Talk about the women's suffrage movement. Talk about the civil rights movement and voter registration battles in the 1960s in the South. They're all about these everyday Americans, inspiring individuals. And I think that's one of the key takeaways that I have from the series of interviews we conducted this year, is that individual people have powerful stories, and they really can make a difference.
Well, what we're talking about here is access to voting. And I'm just wondering if there's a way to create bipartisan, because in the times that we're in again, and in the context that we're in, is it possible to create bipartisan voting rules? Shouldn't that be the ideal?
It is absolutely the ideal, and I think it's something we should strive for. Look, many of you know that I'm a huge baseball fan, a sports fan, and you know, I think sometimes of, if you're talking about two rival teams, this year we have the Dodgers and the Yankees in the World Series. Well, what if the Yankees got to choose the umpires and also the rules of the game that the World Series is going to be played? I mean, no one besides the most diehard Yankees fan would think that's fair. You need all voices in the room to decide the rules of the game. And so I think it's problematic anytime the Democrats are unilaterally passing rules or the Republicans are unilaterally passing rules. Fairness requires that we all have buy-in here. And that's also been one of the themes of my scholarship. It's how I end my new book, where I discuss what I call the grand election compromise. This is a way for us to bridge the gap and talk about voting rights in a bipartisan way. I discuss what I call four principles of a grand election compromise that everyone should agree on if they believe in democracy. So what are those four principles? First, every eligible citizen should have easy access to the ballot. We shouldn't be putting barriers in the place of people casting their vote. Second, the election system should be set up to deter known fraud. Now, we shouldn't be chasing the boogeyman of fraud that, you know, there's no evidence that it actually exists. But if there are certain vulnerabilities in the system, we should ensure that the election process is set up to deter that. Third, voters should be well educated. I don't see how anyone could object to the ideal that the system should be set up in a way to foster stronger voter education. And fourth, democracy does require losing candidates of whatever political party to readily concede defeat once the fight is done. And so I think we need to create a culture and perhaps even rules that foster this idea that if you lose, you go on to fight the next battle. You know, I recall our conversation with my law school classmate, Jamie Long, who is now the majority leader of the Minnesota House of Representatives. Let's play a clip from his interview. Let's talk a little bit more about, you know, your discussion of wanting to expand access to certain constituencies, young people, people of color. You're a pretty blue state. You have a pretty blue state. Minnesota has been reliably Democratic. So what do you say to the, you know, potential criticism that, you know, you're just trying to increase the voters for your side and entrench yourself in the majority?
Yeah. Well, I'd point to Restore the Vote as a good example of a policy that we support, even though I really have no idea how that'll turn out from a partisan standpoint. So just this past year, we passed a law that now allows folks who are formerly incarcerated but not yet off of probation to vote. And that's a significant population in Minnesota. I think there's about 55,000 Minnesotans who in the state are on probation or parole, but not incarcerated anymore. And these folks are all over the state. We know that they are in every single community, rural communities, urban communities. And we heard, I think, bipartisan support for the bill when it came through and folks testifying from different backgrounds. But for us, this was just the right thing to do. We felt like individuals who were returning to society should have their rights restored. We know that is anti-recidivism to have people feel like they're included in society, feel like they're we want them to be a part of society again. It's very pro-social to vote. So I think that, you know, even if the numbers had someone had come to me and said, hey, I think this is going to give a 5 to 10% Republican advantage, I'd say fine. It's the right thing to do. I mean, I think that we know that democracy should be fair, should be open, should be accessible to voters. And that, I think, are the principles that we are standing on in the state.
That was Jamie Long, the majority leader of the Minnesota House of Representatives. Michael Adams, Kentucky's Republican Secretary of State, like me, is a big advocate of bipartisan decision-making around our elections. Here's what Michael Adams told us.
What we found in Kentucky is when we have it formed in bipartisan fashion, when we get people in the room, a Democratic governor, Republican Secretary of State, legislators of both parties, county clerks of both parties, and we work in good faith to try to improve our system, number one, we just get a bigger array of voices and a better array of options for consideration. But also it's a good look because when we go out there and hold a press conference and explain our ideas jointly, it leads voters on both sides of the aisle and non-Democrats and Republicans too, independents, to feel like, well, like this is a real fair system. My vote counts. I'm not going to be discriminated against. One team isn't conspiring to read the election from the other team. We can trust this system. And I do think Kentucky is doing better than the average state right now in terms of public confidence in our elections. We have our challenges. I deal with that every day. But I do think that we're a lot better off here than what we've seen in some other states on that.
That was Kentucky Secretary of State Michael Adams.
So, Josh, some people think that we have to make this choice between access, which we've been talking about, and election integrity. Do you agree that it's one or the other? And how can you assure us that the 2024 election will be secure?
Yeah, that access versus integrity debate to me is a false dichotomy because we can have both. And in many places we do, as Secretary Adams just told us in that clip, you can look at Kentucky. We were a national success story in 2020 during the pandemic. I recall getting calls from reporters, national reporters, asking, you know, what's the secret sauce in Kentucky, or maybe secret bourbon, to figure out why the state has done so well in election administration. And the reason is we had all voices in the room, right? We had Democrats, Republicans, others in between, good government groups, all giving input about how to run elections both fairly and securely. And we passed measures that both improve access and enhance security at the same time. You know, vote by mail is a good example of that. It obviously makes it easier for some people to vote, but it also enhances integrity, especially because the state can watch the ballot and track the ballot through the system. I think about our interview with Amber McReynolds, the vice chair of the United States Postal Service Board of Governors, who told us about how vote by mail is extremely secure.
First, it's really about a lot of the checks and balances that happen before the ballots are ever mailed. When a ballot is mailed out, it has already gone through various checks and balances that actually don't always happen in the same way with regards to in-person voting. And what I mean by that is for a ballot to get to the voter at the correct address and for them to be able to vote that ballot, the election officials have to know where that voter is. They have to have the correct address on file. They have to have that correct information. They're determining eligibility before that ballot is ever mailed out. So if you're inactive or you haven't updated your address in a while or you haven't engaged with the election office, you're not going to be able to get that in the mail until you actually take action, until you contact your election official. So they're only going out to active voters, first and foremost. They're only going out, and this is after various checks and balances happen, but automated things like national change of address check or checks against motor vehicle database, especially in states that leverage the ERIC system, which is a cross-state check of when voters move around the country. All of that is happening before that ballot packet is ever mailed to voters.
That was Amber McReynolds, the vice chair of the United States Postal Service Board of Governors. And yeah, there are concerns about voter intimidation. I'm particularly upset about the threats to election officials who are the heroes of our democratic process. But I do think we can all go to the polls knowing that the system is secure precisely because of this heroic work of these election officials.
Okay, let's talk about a question that you posed to everybody interviewed for this series. And in this instance, to the clerks of Fayette and Madison counties, respectively, Democrat Susan Lamb and Republican Kenny Barger.
Why should people vote? What's the point? Especially, you know, if we think that Kentucky, well, kind of know who's likely to win the presidential election in Kentucky. So why bother?
It allows us to be a part of the solution and to cast your opinion for who you prefer in leadership roles. It's simple for me. You know, if you don't vote, I don't believe you have the right to complain. Be a part of the solution is big for me.
Yeah, I have a bumper sticker in my office that says, if you don't vote, don't whine. Anything to add, Kenny, on why people should vote?
Absolutely. The average drive-through time in a fast food restaurant in the United States of America right now is 6 minutes and 30 seconds. At non-peak times in Madison County, on early voting and election day, it's 10 minutes to vote. So if you're willing to sit, and that's an average time in a drive-through line, if you're willing to sit for 6 minutes and 30 seconds at McDonald's, you should probably be prepared to give 10, 15 minutes to exercise your right as a United States citizen.
That was Democratic Fayette County Clerk Susan Lamb and Republican Madison County Clerk Kenny Barger. So what did you learn from those answers, Joe?
You know, everyone I spoke with, whether they were Republican or Democrat, whether they were involved in the nitty-gritty aspect of running an election or were members of the media, were everyday Americans, they all understood the power of voting, even if they recognized that perhaps they live in a state where their vote's probably not going to make a difference in the electoral college outcome. You just never know when your vote will be the one that decides a local race, a state race. And also, I think there's just some important part of being an American, of all collectively making this decision. You know, our theme song for the show has been this song called Americans with the lyric, "What does it mean to be American?" And to me, it's all about voting, and voting is also the great equalizer as Americans. Of course, so long as we have fair rules about the voting process.
Okay, we're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, Q&A, questions from our audience, from you, here in the Grand Courtroom, the University of Kentucky Rosenberg College of Law. I'm Tom Martin, here with Josh Douglas, and you're listening to Democracy Optimist, a special Eastern Standard series on WEKU. Now we're going to shift to some questions from students who joined us here at the UK Law School Grand Courtroom. Not only are you embarking on a legal education, but you will be the future leaders of Kentucky and of this country. No pressure. But your thoughts really matter to all of us. So we're going to reverse the roles now. And instead of Professor Douglas calling on you, he's in the hot seat. So what do you want to know about how we run our elections? Will Hayden?
Yes. Hi, Professor. My name is Will Hayden. I'm a 2L here at the UK Rosenberg College of Law. My question is, should the right of American citizens to vote be enshrined in the Constitution?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. And as the students who have taken election law know, The U.S. Constitution does not explicitly confer the right to vote. It says it in the negative. It says no state shall deny the right to vote on the basis of various characteristics, race, sex, inability to pay a poll tax, and age. But there's no affirmative right to vote. But 49 of the 50 state constitutions do have an affirmative right to vote in the state constitution. Now, that language used to say something like every citizen shall be a qualified voter. And there are a handful of states, including Kentucky this year, that have state constitutional amendments on the ballot to change the language from every citizen shall be a voter to only a citizen. In Kentucky, that's amendment number one on the ballot. And the point of that, I think, is to try to make it clear that non-citizens are not allowed to vote, although it's already illegal under federal law, and Kentucky law doesn't allow it either. But there are some places, Maryland, New York, New York City, although that law is going through the courts, California, Vermont, where non-citizens are allowed to vote in local or school board elections. So I think the point of the amendment is to try to say localities in these states can't do it. But all of that is to say that state constitutions actually go beyond the U.S. Constitution in protecting the right to vote. And then you have the U.S. Supreme Court, which in my view has failed to properly give robust protection for voting in the federal constitution. So what the court has said is that it's part of the equal protection clause. You know, we need equality in our democracy. And there was a line of cases in the 1960s that robustly protected the right to vote under the equal protection clause. And now the court has pulled back on that. So the answer to your question is yes. If there was a more explicit and affirmative right to vote in the U.S. Constitution, I think along with direction to the U.S. Supreme Court about how it needed to construe that right, then you'd have much better case law in the federal courts protecting voters. And one problem with the state constitution, state court approach, is that some state courts just say, well, we're going to follow the U.S. Supreme Court, even though state constitutions explicitly and textually confer voting rights more broadly, the state courts basically say, well, it's easier to just follow the U.S. Supreme Court's lead. So I do think if we had an affirmative right to vote in the U.S. Constitution, then you'd have better federal court jurisprudence and hopefully better state court jurisprudence to protect all voters.
Okay, next question. And by the way, just to streamline things a little bit, as you step up, instead of me introducing you, if you would just introduce yourself. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Chastity McCain. I'm a 2L here at UK Law. My question is that voter ID has been a hot topic in recent elections. Proponents claim that it would help ensure the legitimacy of democracy. However, these documents require permanent addresses and funds that the poorest of us may not have access to. Do you feel that requiring these documents would amount to a poll tax? And would the issue be remedied by providing this documentation for free?
Yeah, great question about voter ID law. I have to just point of privilege here. You told me that the day we're recording is your birthday. So happy birthday to Chastity. Great question on voter ID. And this really is a question of access versus integrity, right? The voter ID laws, some of them make it harder for some people to vote. And one thing that's important to recognize is that not all voter ID laws are made the same. Some states have very strict laws, like Texas, that says you can't use your university student ID issued by the University of Texas, but your gun license does count. Wisconsin has a very restrictive law. North Carolina's was restrictive until court struck it down. In fact, in North Carolina, the federal appeals court said that the law was passed with almost surgical precision to target minority voters, because it just so happens that demographically, minority voters tend not to have the same kinds of IDs as others in a state that restricts what type of ID is allowed. But then you have the milder states, and I'm really proud of what we did here in Kentucky. I was fortunate to be in the so-called room where it happens in the debate about Kentucky's voter ID law, and lots of things count. Your student ID does count. It doesn't have to have an expiration date. And if you show up to the polls and for whatever reason you don't have an ID, you can fill out a form under penalty of perjury that says you are who you say you are, it attests to your identity, and then you can vote a regular ballot just like everybody else. Now, in some states, if you don't have your ID, you have to vote a provisional ballot, and then you have to go through additional steps to make that ballot count. In Kentucky, fill out the form under penalty of perjury, which does, you know, get referred to the local law enforcement just to check to make sure there isn't any problem, and you can vote a regular ballot. So I think some states, yes, your question is right that, you know, requiring the underlying documentation like a birth certificate, which costs money, can essentially amount to a poll tax. But if you have a voter ID law that's of the milder form, like we do have here in Kentucky, it's not causing a disenfranchising effect. Now, we can also talk about the integrity improvement, and I think studies show that there's really no fraud of the kind that a voter ID law would prevent. There's no in-person impersonation going on. But if people feel better about the system with an ID law, fine, as long as we pass one that has enough exceptions and enough fail-safe measures not to disenfranchise valid voters.
Hi, my name is Brooke Allison, and I'm a 2L here at the law school. My question is, why do we have a winner-take-all system for the state's electors in the Electoral College when it's not in the Constitution? And what would you say to a voter who is in a decidedly red or blue state who feels discouraged from voting because they believe their vote does not matter because of the Electoral College?
Great question about the Electoral College, Brooke. And there are kind of two things going on here. One, on the winner take all for the states to award their Electoral College votes. Well, 48 states do that. There's actually two states that award their Electoral College votes by district, Nebraska and Maine. There's a lot of focus right now on Nebraska, the Omaha district, essentially, because if you look at the electoral map, if Kamala Harris wins Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, and Donald Trump wins the other swing states, then the election actually would come down to that Omaha district. And assuming all the other states go how we think they will go, how the polls suggest. And actually, if she wins that Omaha district, she would win by one Electoral College vote. And if she loses, it would be a 269-269 tie, which in my view is kind of a nightmare scenario for people's faith in the system. The election would be sent to the House of Representatives, and the House would choose the president voting by state delegation. So there'd be 50 votes. Each state gets one vote to choose the president. But you're right that how states decide whether to do winner-take-all for their Electoral College votes or district by district is not in the Constitution. Because what the U.S. Constitution says is that every state legislature gets to decide for itself how to award Electoral College votes. And at the founding, the many states just had their legislature just decide, we want this person to get our Electoral College votes. Now, all states have decided that the people get to choose. But as noted, 48 states have decided it's a winner-take-all system. But, you know, not for this election because the states have already decided this, but for the next presidential election, a state could choose to change up how they want to do it. They could do it proportionally. They could use a ranked choice voting system. They could do districts like Nebraska and Maine do, where two electors go to the statewide winner, and then otherwise each district gets an Electoral College vote. So there are lots of permutations, and there's people, reformers, talking about a better way to do this. And I think it's worthwhile as we discuss whether the Electoral College makes sense in this day and age, whether we should think about different ways for states to award their Electoral College votes. Now, on your question about, you know your state's going to go for Trump or Harris, why vote? Well, one, you only know that if everyone else votes that way. I mean, you never know. But I think, you know, I'm a realist and in addition to an optimist, and I recognize that basically 43 states in D.C. are going to go the way we think it's going to, and there's seven so-called swing states that'll decide this election. But there's so many other races on the ballot as well. There's statewide, there's local, there's ballot initiatives, and you just never know when your vote might be the one that makes the difference.
I'm Will Cockrell.
I'm a 2L here at the law school. And my question is that Kentucky Secretary of State Michael Adams, who we heard from earlier, came and spoke at the law school recently. And he voiced that it was his opinion that a four-day voting window is more preferable to an election day national holiday where everybody goes and votes on one day. So is it your opinion that that system, the four-day voting period, is more preferable, or would you prefer election day being essentially a national holiday?
Yeah, you hear this a lot, particularly, I think, from the left, that they want election day to be a federal holiday. And I think it's a bad idea, generally speaking. And the reason for that is that there are unintended consequences that would come from calling election day a national holiday. For one, you'd have many businesses close. So employees who are hourly workers are out a day of work. And, you know, that would fall more heavily on people of a lower socioeconomic class. And, you know, the state can't mandate a business to pay their hourly employees hourly wages for a day that the business closes because it's a federal holiday. Daycares would probably close as well. So parents with kids would have to find alternative daycare. Now, I'm a big believer in bringing your kids to the polls. I brought my kids ever since they were babies. That's not voter fraud, just because the kids were there, even though, you know, I remember once when I had one of my kids vote with me at the machine and then went over to my wife and voted while my wife was voting. That's not double voting. They didn't actually cast their ballot. It shows them the value of civic participation. Actually, I remember one time the lines were kind of long, and I had brought the Dr. Seuss book, One Vote, Two Vote, Red Vote, Blue Vote, and I read it to the various kids waiting in line with their parents, which was kind of fun. But that gets me to, again, the problem of daycares closing and having to find alternative daycare, when who are you going to help, right? We already know that, at least in the presidential election, about two-thirds of the people vote. I wish it was more. So we're trying to target that one-third, and that one-third often is going to be of a lower socioeconomic class. And so how do we help those people vote? And something like an early voting window is much more preferable. Now, I think the state should have maybe 7 days of early voting. I'm not sure that three is enough. The Kentucky law that passed initially was going to have seven, and then it got cut down to four, and at the last minute cut down to three. Three is better than the one we had previously. So instead of a national holiday, I think we should expand our early voting and our vote by mail possibilities.
I'm Ben Bertram. I'm a 2L here at UK. My question is, who has the authority to determine if an election is secure, and will we ever be able to tell with 100% certainty?
Yeah, I mean, so there are lots of processes in the election system that the voters don't necessarily see or watch carefully, although I think there's more attention being paid to them now. So every state has an election board, whether it starts at the county level with the county board of elections, and then ultimately a state board of elections or a state election official who certifies the results of the election. And part of that certification is monitoring the process. It's going through post-election audits, and there are best practices for what post-election audits look like. They'll do things like look at the machine totals in a particular precinct and compare that to the absentee ballot totals in a precinct. And in fact, there was an election that had to be redone in North Carolina in 2018 after they found actual election fraud by a Republican election operative. And they caught it because the vote totals for each of the candidates coming from the machines, the in-person votes, versus the absentee votes were totally out of whack. And so they said, well, something weird's going on here. Let's investigate further. And so there are tons of different checks on the election system. I always like to tell people that what you hear on election night or the day after is not the official winner. The official winner is not declared for, you know, a week or two later when the election officials actually certify the results. Now, your question was also, can we ever tell with 100% certainty? Well, that's sort of like asking you to prove a negative. You know, when my kids were little and they'd say there's a monster under the bed, look for the monster. And I'd look for the monster and, nope, there's no monster. Well, how do I prove to them that there's no monster under the bed. How do you prove something doesn't exist? And that has been, I think, a challenge. But the reality is people are looking for this. They're looking really hard to find this election fraud because of the false narrative that's gone on in our elections, and they haven't been able to find it. And so I think we can all feel very secure that our elections are run with integrity, run correctly, because of the hard work of election officials, because of these post-election audits, and because we're looking for it and haven't found it.
My name's John Childress, and I'm a 2L at UK Law. And my question was, should we abolish the current partisan system we have for electing officials that work on elections like our county clerks, for example? What are the advantages, if any, and how has a nonpartisan approach worked for European countries?
Yeah, John, you know, we're the only country in the world of democratic modern democracies where our people who run elections are partisan operatives, or at least wear partisan hats. And you talk to people in Europe and other places around the world, and they think this is totally crazy. I mean, it's absurd to have someone who runs as a Democrat or Republican then say, okay, we're going to wear our nonpartisan hat in running elections. Now, I will say that virtually all election officials in the U.S. do a really great job of taking off that partisan hat, of working in service of all voters and working in service of making sure the election system is secure. But the optics aren't good either with respect to whether our system is being run in a fair and efficient manner. And in other countries, in places in, you know, the United Kingdom and lots of places in Europe, they have nonpartisan, professional, independent election workers, election officials, boards of elections that oversee the process. And I think people feel more secure about the elections as a result. So I do strongly think that we should not be voting for our election officials, the people who run elections, in a partisan manner. I think we should take off the partisan hats for their elections. Luckily, again, most of these people are really great public servants, but you do hear of some, you know, kind of bad apples on both sides who it's pretty clear what their motivations are when they're crafting and implementing the voting rules. And I think that is a harm to the way we run our elections.
I'm Dylan Diedrich. I'm a 2L here at UK Law, and I just wanted to say lifetime appointments are intended to have justices be impartial, since they do not need to worry about seeking re-election. But it also means that some presidents may be able to pack the court with justices who align with them ideologically. What are your thoughts on having extended term limits for Supreme Court justices? Perhaps it could be staggered in a way where each president gets one to two Supreme Court picks. And do you think the Supreme Court is going to end up deciding this election?
Yeah, so I think two things going on in your question here, right? One is, how do we reform the Supreme Court if it needs to be reformed? And that's kind of the longer term question. And then second, will the court get involved in the 2024 election? So first, on reforming the court, you know, I wrote a whole book about why I think the Supreme Court has been harmful on voting rights in particular. And at the end of that book, I discuss some solutions for how to fix the way the court operates. I'm not a fan of packing the court. You hear some people on the left talk about, well, you know, Republicans so-called stole some seats on the court, and so now it's time for the Democrats to add more. I'm not a fan of that. That sounds like a political tit-for-tat with no end game. And so, okay, Democrats add four justices, and then Republicans add four more, and that doesn't seem to work. But I do think term limits, like you mentioned in your question, are a useful idea. In the book, I talk about 18-year term limits as one possible mechanism. That way, every president gets two appointments in every four-year term. You know, my book came out in May, and I heard Joe Biden in like June or July come out with this idea as well as term limits, 18-year term limits. I assume he read my book. I don't know. There are other organizations who have also talked about term limits as the idea. That's one possible solution. I also think we can be more innovative in the way the court operates. For example, the federal courts of appeals hear cases, as you all know, as in three-judge panels drawn from a much larger bench of the full court. Why don't we do that for the Supreme Court, right? You could have them sit in panels. Hopefully that would to turn down the temperature of the Supreme Court nomination battles and also, you know, make the cases more about the law and the precedent and not the ideological split on the court. We also have federal judges do what they call sit by designation. So a district judge, a trial judge becomes an appeals court judge for a case, an appeals court judge becomes a trial judge. Why don't we have that happen at the Supreme Court as well? I think these are long-term solutions, not something that's going to happen overnight, but the conversation should continue. Now, on whether the court is going to decide this election, I don't think that's going to happen ultimately. I mean, you couldn't envision a Bush v. Gore type scenario where one state comes down to a few hundred votes. And if that's the case, then yeah, I do think that the court might be asked to get involved. But I think this court in particular wants to stay out of it, wants to let the political process play out. And so the likelihood that the court actually decides to insert itself, in my view, is pretty small.
Hi, my name's Taryn Grundy, and I'm a 2L here at Rosenberg College of Law. My question for you is, do you see the value in the use of social media apps such as TikTok to campaign to and educate Generation Z? And if you do think, and if so, do you think this form of education is too casual?
Taryn, I love that question because it gets to one of my concerns about our voting patterns, which is that younger people tend not to vote. You know, as you get older, the likelihood you vote becomes higher if you just look at the demographics. But of course, younger people are going to have to deal with the consequences of the policies that our elected officials enact for, you know, decades to come. And so we do need to think about ways to reach young people. So I'm very much a fan of using whatever social media platforms exist out there that young people are paying attention to, so long as we also fix the misinformation and disinformation that goes on these platforms. So one thing that the younger generation has to do, is make sure that the information they're learning about is truthful, is to check their sources, is to take everything you hear with a bit of skepticism, not to share something unless you verified its truth. There are also traditional media entities that are engaged in really great voter information and voter outreach. You know, the Kentucky NPR stations have just come out with this guide where you can put your address in and it will give you not only what your ballot will look like, who's on the ballot in statewide races, but you can click through and learn about each of the candidates. It's a really great resource. You can find it at vote.kentuckypublicradio.org. Bolts Magazine is another great resource. They have this something called What's on the Ballot Cheat Sheet that lists basically everything on the ballot nationwide. And so I'd love to see social media platforms like TikTok have those sorts of resources linked so that young people can access information they need to participate. So yes, I don't think it's too casual at all. I think we need to figure out a way to reach everyone wherever they are, because ultimately, I want a democracy where everyone participates.
My name is Dalton Gregory, and I'm a 2L at UK Law. And my question is, has the decline of local media contributed to the nationalization of local politics, or did the nationalization of local politics lead to the decline in local media? And could revitalizing local media help to denationalize local politics?
I think it's both, Dalton. I think that, you know, both the decline of local media and the way in which it's funded, its support, has created a vacuum where national media has jumped in. And, you know, now you see a lot of these local newspapers all owned by the same big conglomerate corporation. And yet also that, the nationalization of local politics, where now, you know, you get these local races that are often driven by what's going on nationally, has led to this problem where, you know, everything is seen through a partisan lens. I actually think local elections that are nonpartisan are often better if those campaigns can get into the issues and if there are strong local media that can cover them. So, you know, the message here, I think, is it's neither one or the other. I think it's both. But we can help to fix that by, look, subscribe to your local newspaper. I know most people don't get it in print anymore, but subscribe online to your local newspaper. support local public radio because they're doing such great work in educating people, and we need more of that to combat this trend of the tribalism that has infected our local politics as well.
Hello, my name is Megan Hashemi. I am a 3L at UK Law. My question for you is, how can college and law students help in the upcoming election? Is there anything we can be doing to ensure people go out and vote?
Yeah, I think you can focus on getting your friends and family members to the polls. I mean, you know, at right now when we're recording this, we're less than 2 weeks from the election in Kentucky. The voter registration deadline, unfortunately, has passed. If you're listening in another state, many states have same-day voter registration, so it doesn't even matter if you're registered or not at the time. You can go to the polls and register then. But, you know, if every person here got five people who otherwise maybe weren't going to vote to get to the polls, drive them to the polls if they need to. I remember I got one of my friends who had gotten his U.S. citizenship somewhat recently, and he was sort of going back and forth, and I basically said, hey, I'm going to pick you up. What time are you available? On election day, I'm going to pick you up. We're going to go vote together. And now he's a regular voter. And so I think, you know, the nitty-gritty of right before the election, what we can do is help in the get-out-the-vote efforts from everybody. Voter education is also a huge part of this. And so, again, check your sources and send to the people who might be skeptics about whatever your view is actual verifiable information that can really help in creating a more informed electorate as well.
Hi, I'm Maddie Glazier, and I'm a second-year law student here at UK Law. My question is, what can law students and the legal community do to support democracy?
So, similar to what I just said to Megan about, you know, getting people out to the polls, but law students also can play a role in voter protection. So there are organizations that are doing voter protection for voters who have issues at the polls. And so you can sign up to be someone who basically gets phone calls from national organizations that hear from voters, and they often are in swing states, but they can be in non-swing states as well. And you help document the problems that they faced and help find the solution. So I think law students and lawyers can be useful on that front on the early voting days and on election day. So just search for voter protection services, and they're always looking for volunteers, particularly law student volunteers, to help in voter protection.
Hello, my name is Tori Harris, and I'm a 2L here at UK. So you have asked every guest on your podcast this question, so you should formally answer the question, why should people vote?
I love it. The tables are turned on me. Yeah, at the end of every interview, I've asked our guests, why should people vote? So I love that you are turning that question back on me. Well, again, if you're in a state where you think you know who's going to win the presidential election in your state, the Electoral College votes in your state, you might think that your vote doesn't matter. But as I mentioned previously, there are statewide races, there are local races, there are ballot initiatives, statewide ballot initiatives, local ballot initiatives. And let me tell you a quick story from an election a few years ago. This came in Virginia, and the control of the Virginia House of Representatives, whether the Democrats controlled the House or the Republicans, came down to one district in the entire state. And the election in that district literally came down to one vote. And so whether Democrats were able to engage in their agenda over those next 2 years, or whether Republicans were able to do that those next 2 years, came down to one vote in one district. Now, that usually doesn't happen, right? But you can never predict when that might be the case. And so, you know, why should people vote? Because your voice might actually make a difference in the outcome of an election that you can't predict and you might care a lot about. Even if it's not the you personally affecting the outcome of the Electoral College. Now, the other thing I'd say is that there's, I think, intrinsic value in participating. There's intrinsic value in saying that we live in a free country where, you know, the Declaration of Independence says that a government is legitimate based on the consent of the governed. Consent of the governed, shouldn't that include all of us? Even if you think your vote isn't going to be the one that makes the difference in the election. Well, of course, if everyone thought that, then we would have no one show up to vote, right? So obviously, votes matter. But it also matters because it's what it means to live in a democratic republic that our Constitution has set up. It's what it means to be an American. You know, what does it mean to be an American? To participate in civic life, to participate in democracy, and that means voting.
All right, we want to thank everybody for spending the hour with us. This has been episode 17 of Democracy Optimist. It's our final episode of this election year series, but you haven't heard the last of Josh Douglas on WEKU or on Eastern Standard. He'll be returning from time to time as we explore questions and concerns about election law, voting rights, democracy, which are bound to come up in the near future. So, Josh, we really want to thank you for the effort you've made.
Thank you. This has been a really fun series to do in this election year, and I'm looking forward to continuing Democracy Optimist and continuing to be a Democracy Optimist in the months and years ahead.
We're all knocking on wood. And also big thanks to Dynamics Productions and Neil Kesterson, seated behind me here, for all the behind-scenes engineering that's made all this possible. Mike Savage is our executive producer, Mason Graber, Stephen Dabney, research assistants, Caitlin Douglas, graphic designer. The Democracy Optimist theme song, American, is by Madeline Peru. And we're online at democracyoptimist.com. Podcast versions available on Apple, Spotify, NPR, wherever you get your podcast. And if you want to get in touch, you can email us at democracyoptimist@gmail.com. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Democracy Optimist from Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Educate myself on the fight.